Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 353 for October 28 of 2016, GMC Acadia, the Goldilocks of SUVs. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Autoline After Hours. Mr. Vasilash.
John, how are you? You just got back today from a drive program?
I was on the refresh of the Audi A3 and S3, and that's what we drove all the time, was S3s. And we can probably talk a little bit about that later on. There's no embargo on it. But we got to let everybody know we got Joanne Muller back here from Forbes Magazine. All right.
Nice to be here again. Thank you.
Yeah. And our special guest right now is back by popular demand, Paul Spadafora. Now, Paul, the last time that you were here, you were talking about the Cadillac XT5. But now you're here to talk about the GMC Acadia. So first of all, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you really oversee various vehicles coming off the same platform, is that
well,
right?
Well, it was an all-new architecture for us, John. So we've introduced the Cadillac XT5, which was the first in the sister program in China, which is the XT5 localized for the Chinese market. And really proud to talk about the 2017 GMC Acadia today. It's a fantastic vehicle, and it really hits the market segment perfectly, we believe.
Now, I know you've taken a lot of weight on out of this thing, and I want to get to that in a moment. And I thought you had considerably downsized it. But when I see it parked here in the studio, this thing still is a full-size vehicle.
Well, when you compare it to the 2016 GMC Acadia, it has been right-sized. And why did we do that? We actually listened to our customer base. So we do a lot of clinics. We pulled in people in this segment, and we really asked them, what do you like, and why do you want to buy a GMC Acadia? What puts you in this market? And it's interesting. A large portion of the customers told us that I absolutely need to have a third row in my vehicle, third row of seating in my vehicle, but I rarely use it. So I need that third row if I invite another couple out to dinner, if I have two couples out to dinner, if I am a family of five and a couple of kids come along, if the in-laws or grandparents come along, I need another row of seating. However, it's a very infrequent usage. So what we did is we were able to take the vehicle from 2016 to our all-new 2017. It's actually 7 inches shorter, 3.5 inches narrower, and 4 inches lower. And so by doing that, we gained a significant, reduced a significant amount of mass, but yet we're still able to offer three rows of seating for the customers. And you know, early success, how are we doing? Well, initially, I'm proud to say that the 2017 GMC Acadia, it's the fastest turning vehicle in the GM segment, meaning it spends the least amount of time on dealers' lots. So the early returns are telling us that by listening to our customer base, it's really resonated well.
Paul, you're taking exterior size out, but you're not limiting it on the inside.
We've certainly become more efficient. That's a great point. We've become more efficient. So the exterior size are the dimensions I just quoted, the 7 inches, the 3.5, and the 4, and we are much more efficient. So it's not a one-for-one reduction, but certainly the interior space has gone down as well in an opportunity to reduce the mass, and which is the next thing I think we can segue into. We've taken 700 pounds from 2016 to 2017. It's over a 700-pound reduction.
And this is not aluminum intensive or anything like that?
No, we've done this without using extensive aluminum or exotic materials. We've done it through what I like to say is just smart engineering, you know, advanced analytics. We've taken a lot of high-strength steel, and we've joined them in a lot of dissimilar thicknesses. We've used advanced bonding techniques. We've used structural sealers. So we've done all of this, and really we've attacked every ounce that was not required. And it was done through the analysis we're able to run today is just phenomenal. We're able to take a look analytically at where we need the strength, and that's where we're going to add the high strength steel. Where we don't need the strength, we're going to eliminate it. And we've done that. I mean, one good example of that is we were just awarded the IIHS top safety pick. And the reason we were able to do that, one of the requirements that IIHS is requiring is what they call a small offset. That's two vehicles moving in opposite directions, kind of simulating a two-lane road. And the intersection is only, you know, the collision section is only about 10% overlap. So a very stringent test case. Through the analysis, we're able to run, we take what we traditionally have, straight rails. We were able to bow them out to be able to take on any type of oncoming traffic. But analytically, we were able to engineer it to take a front load as well. So as we do that, we're able to get a very efficient, very light vehicle. And you can imagine 700 pounds less than what we have today, the things we're able to do from a maneuverability, parkability, garageability, just nimbleness of drive, fuel economy. We have two powertrains we can talk about in a little bit. And we're not just comparing it to ourselves. If you look at some of the segment leaders or some of the people in our segment, the new Toyota Highlander, it's 2 inches shorter than what we're offering here, and it's 200 pounds heavier. So we think we've made a significant improvement in mass, and it's really going to resonate as you drive the vehicle.
So, but when people hear that it is 700 pounds lighter, they might think it's in some ways flimsy, but you're saying that this is structurally even better than it might have otherwise been because of the analysis you guys are running?
That's exactly right. We are, again, top safety pick for IIHS. We're anticipating a five-star vehicle. We've met all of our torsional requirements for body stiffness, which gives you an excellent ride and handling. And we were able to do that just by more efficient use of materials. Absolutely. It's just as strong, in fact, stronger and able to meet all the requirements that it needs to meet while giving you a much nicer driving experience. And by the way, with that less mass, we now have two engine offerings. Not only do we have the 3.6 V6, which offers 310 horsepower, 272 pounds of torque, but we also now are able to offer a four-cylinder, 2.5-liter four-cylinder, which has a first for GMC start-stop system. So as you're driving down the, you know, as you come to a complete stop, if you don't have a lot of loads on the electrical system, it will stop you at a stoplight, and it will systematically restart you as you accelerate. And so this goes along with that philosophy of efficiency. If you're stopped at a stoplight or you're idling, you don't need to use unneeded gasoline, right? We're gonna save you money. We're only going to give you the power as you need it. And that allows us to get 22 miles city and 26 miles highway on that four-cylinder. And even on the six-cylinder, that efficiency theme that we've utilized for mass and on the four-cylinder, we have cylinder deactivation. So if you're on the highway and you're driving, you're cruising along at a consistent speed, we're going to deactivate two of the cylinders and put you in four-cylinder mode. So again, if you don't need it, we're not going to offer it to you, and you're going to save fuel economy. But if you need to press on the gas, we're going to give you the full 310 horsepower, 272 pounds of torque, and off you go. So again, it's at this concept of giving you only what you need when you need it and being very, very strict about waste, if you will.
What's the improvement in fuel economy from the older generation to the new?
We'll have to pull up the numbers. Again, we're at 22.26 with the four-cylinder, and we're at 17.25. So, again, I think that's top of the segment. We're very proud of what we're able to get.
Well, Joanne, you own the last generation.
I do. It's a 2016. Actually, we got a good deal on it, probably. So it's very interesting, right? So I've always liked the Acadia. We bought it to replace a minivan after our kids got a little older. So when I heard that you were making it smaller, I frankly was confused and a little skeptical. But what's remarkable is that when I actually drove the thing, and my husband felt the same way, we thought, this is perfect. It is just right. It's like Goldilocks.
Wait, the new one or the one
you
have? The new
one. The new one. I just found it more comfortable, you know, I didn't feel like I was climbing a horse to get into it, right? It didn't feel as fat, especially in the rear. It just felt right. And it's a weird feeling when you get in the car and you say, okay, they got this right. And kudos to you guys, because I was skeptical, but it really is nice. Frankly, I'm looking forward to our trade-in.
See, they really did listen.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joanne. I mean, but that's very typical, you know, and as we talk to the customers of the current Acadia, the previous generation Acadia, and others in the segment, they were so adamant about it has to be a large vehicle, it has to have three rows, and then when you start peeling back the onion and say, well, how frequently do you use a third row, and what do you use the vehicle for, and a lot of that same revelation came about that, well, it doesn't need to be as big, but I do need to have, whether it be 5, 6, or 7 passenger seating, and it does need to have nice cargo. And so we really did put a great focus on it. So cargo space, for example, we're about 42 cubic feet when you put down the third row, and we're almost 80 feet of cubic cargo when you put down the second and third row. So, you know, we've listened to the customer base. You have all the cargo space that you need, and you have all the...
practically a tiny house.
Yeah, you'd live in it later on.
Yeah.
you know, what I found interesting is that, you know, as you pointed out, John, I mean, you look at this, it looks like a big vehicle. Then you hear it has a 4-cylinder engine in it, and you say to yourself, oh, that can't possibly be.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I've driven it, and it is amazing that, you know, that gets the performance that someone really, in real life driving, find fully capable.
Yeah, we're very pleased with the 4-cylinder engine as well. And you're right, it is very capable. At 193 horsepower, 190 foot-pounds of torque, it's a nice package, and it offers the fuel economy we just stated. So for everyday living and everyday functionality, it's a really good alternative. But then it's also nice to have the other end of the spectrum with the 310 horsepower V6. For those that like to tow, you're able to tow up to 4,000 pounds. So it's always a good strategy to offer kind of both ends of the spectrum there for a customer base.
Hey, we just got a question here from Joel Rollins via Twitter. He says, ask Paul how this was released without the 9-speed. He goes on to say the Malibu was released earlier but has it.
Interesting. As we went forward and we looked at the powertrain combination and the system that we have, the 6-speed was more than appropriate, an internal transmission. We got great reliability, durability, great experience with it. It just seemed to fit hand in glove with the customer base that we have.
Gotcha.
Now, you offer a version called the all-terrain. Now, what does that do?
So, Gary, that's a great question. So as we started, you know, these customer research and talking to the current customers, they really revealed a lot. I talked about a segment of the population that said, I rarely use a third row, but I really need it. There was also a segment of that subgroup that said, I never use my third row. I have it because I want to take advantage of the size of the vehicle, and it tows fantastic. So I buy the car, I fold the seat down, and when I turn it in, I'll turn it back up and give it back to the dealer. So when we listen to that, and that type of persona, GMC buyer likes to be active, likes to tow, and likes a little more expressive styling. So we developed an all-new model, an all-terrain to go along with this, which is a 5-seater, meaning it does not have a third row. It has a rubber cargo mat, which is extremely functional. So if you think about an active lifestyle, whether you're putting a snowmobile in there or bikes or whatever the case may be, it cleans up easy. The exterior is a very darkened, aggressive, bold look. So it's got a unique exterior, and it's got an extremely capable all-wheel drive system. So it's a dual-clutch all-wheel drive. So virtually what that means is you're able to drive down the road, and if you're on a split-mew condition, meaning half the road is extremely slippery, it'll automatically transfer the force to where you have traction. And virtually, you know, I guess theoretically, if you only have traction on one wheel, it will transfer all the force to one wheel and get you unstuck.
Wow.
So it really does fit the persona of this customer. As we went through and we interviewed Acadia buyers and Acadia customers, this is a segment of the population that we think is underrepresentative and we think is going to do very well.
Mm-hmm. Is this platform going to flow through to the other brands as well?
It possibly could. Yeah, there's not a whole lot.
It seems to me a Chevrolet Traverse ought to be replaced at some point.
Yeah.
You know, all I can say on that is extremely mass efficient. And we've developed this car and these vehicles to be very efficient and to be very state of the art. So would not be surprising if we were to see more come off it, but I have no news to share today.
You can't tell us. It's the old you'd have to kill us line. Hey, we got another question here from Lex, who says, would GMC ever consider having a Hummer-type vehicle, maybe an H4 as a sub-brand?
Well, I can't say we've had those discussions, but I think if you think about the all-terrain and the persona, it's not much of a stretch that, you know, we want to take that customer base, because the professional grade, off-road, more capable, I think that's really where we're starting to get into this all-terrain territory, and there certainly is a market segment for that.
Mm-hmm. You also have the Denali version of this car, so a little higher trim level.
We do, and Denali's been just such a pleasant experience. I mean, what we found is Denali has become its own brand within GMC. It's been wildly successful, and I think that's a tribute to the marketing and leadership team here at GM and at GMC. It's a very well-defined model, and it's really become a sub-brand. The success that we've had on every GMC that we've offered it has been nothing short of phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, in our particular case, we have a Denali in the showroom. It's all real materials inside. It's real aluminum trims. It's hard wood, real wood. You look at the exterior, very expressive. The chrome, real chrome, very expressive, and the advanced safety features. It is your fully loaded model, and it does very well as a sub-brand. I think Denali is recognized as top-of-the-line GMC, and it's doing very well.
It's got to be the best-selling trim line in the business, just about. I mean, the public awareness of the Denali, it's a trim line. It blows my mind. In fact, we ran something in Autoline Daily in the last couple of weeks that somebody had done a study and determined that the Denali brand generates more revenue than Land Rover does in the U.S. market and a couple of other major brands, too. And I'm going, for a trim level, that's spectacular. It's a brilliant marketing success. Mm-hmm.
And then
really
their friends at Buick have copied it with the Avenir forthcoming to have their own special brand. So you mentioned safety. Now, what is available in this vehicle? I mean, what did you guys have to apply to make this a top safety pick plus?
Well, there's a slew of safety features that we have. There's pedestrian detection. There's front collision alert. We have lane keep assist. We have side object detection. We have adaptive cruise. Really, when you start thinking about it, a lot of the key technologies that enable autonomous driving, we already have in a lot of our vehicles, and particularly in a vehicle of this content level. So just for example, the lane keep assist. So what we do with lane keep assist is you put the lane keep assist on, and essentially it will keep you between the white lines. It will gently nudge you to the center of the lane and keep you perfectly centered. But yet it's smart enough that if I apply a certain amount of torque in the steering wheel, it's going to know that I intentionally wanted to change lanes, and it's going to allow me to do that. Now you couple with that the cruise control, the smart cruise, where it keeps an appropriate and safe following distance, those two features together, you start to make up the makings of, you know, an autonomous driving type vehicle. So something that gives us an advantage over the rest is we have thousands of miles of data and being able to perfect these sort of things. Mm-hmm. Another key feature that I really like is, you know, when you come into your garage at low speeds, it gives you a 360 view of the vehicle. So you're able to really see, for garageability, parkability, you're really able to see what's around you to be able to park. And then, of course, there's the infotainment system. So we offer 4G LTE, which very very popular among the younger generations. I'm the star of my household with my kids because I have that.
Which means you have Wi-Fi in the car. Is another translation 4G of 4G LTE, right?
You got it, John. And then along with that is Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. So virtually I can take my phone in the vehicle, plug in, and the vehicle becomes my phone becomes the vehicle, and I'm totally integrated with it. Mm-hmm. We were just awarded the Ward's Top 10 for user experience.
No kidding.
And that was based on ease of use of the radio system, or like we call it, like to call it the infotainment system. We have very strategic placement of the USB ports and charging stations. We also, again, have the Wi-Fi, the CarPlay, the Android Auto, and it just seems to integrate and play well together. So it's good to be recognized for that. And when you look at the customer base, this vehicle really does become, you know, an extension of the person. You know, a lot of them will have families in here. They spend a lot of time in their car. So what you do with your phone, how the technology operates, how you charge your phones is very critical in a vehicle of three rows and of this size. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick commercial break right now. We got more questions, and we want to talk more about the Acadia. But first, we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back with Paul Spadafora talking all about the GMC Acadia. We've got another question here that came in via Twitter. Robert Davies says, why doesn't it have auto-up driver's window like my Sonic has?
Huh.
Interesting. Heads-up display is obviously something we look at.
No, not heads-up, an automatic driver-up window that, you know.
One-touch window?
One-touch window, right, for going up.
Again, all I can say is we listened to the customer and we took the data. That was not a feature that we had offered at this time. We certainly have the technology to do that. It's
wasn't
considered in the top 10 or the customer desires or wishes for the vehicle.
Gotcha.
Now, one thing you have in this car that you didn't talk about is the rear seat reminder. Talk about that. I mean, that's an interesting technology.
Thank you for bringing it up. You know, this is something we're really passionate about. You know, unfortunately, this is a real tragic condition. You know, heat stroke is a reality with small children that are unintentionally left in the vehicle. You know, as we're talking today, already in 2016, 28 children have died of heat stroke in the back of vehicles when they've been unintentionally left there. So we've seen that statistic, General Motors, GMC, and me personally. And the one thing we want to do with the 2017 GMC Acadia, if we could prevent just one of those cases from occurring, it would be successful. But I think we're in the majority of those cases, I think we have a solution. And basically what happens is when you open the rear door, the vehicle senses that the door's been open. You'll go about, you'll run your errand, you'll go to your stop. As soon as you power off, it remembers that that rear door was open, and it will give you a rear seat reminder to say, check your back seat, and a very loud chime to remind you. So a very simple concept, but one that could save a lot of lives. So again, a very tragic situation. Children's body temperatures rise 5 times faster than an adult human, if you will. And so even in conditions where we feel, well, it's really not that hot or not that cold out, it really is. And, you know, these tragic deaths are occurring at a rapid rate, and this is a small part of how we can prevent it.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. I hadn't heard of that. That's pretty good. Good for you guys for doing that.
It's industry first, right?
It is an industry first and a GM first, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking about your infotainment system earlier, too. And one thing I will say about GM vehicles in general is that the voice recognition system is really great. I'd say probably the best that I've encountered. There's so many times when I will talk to the car, I've got my phone hooked up Bluetooth, and I'll say, you know, call so-and-so, and it gives me all the wrong information, you know. It just doesn't understand what I'm saying. And GM, I have never had a problem. First try, every time, and even unusual spellings or pronunciations, it picks them up like that. And I don't know, is that a... is that a software thing, a microphone thing? How are you able to achieve such ease compared to some others?
It's a little bit of both, and thank you for saying that. But you're absolutely right. We spend a lot of time and we log a lot of miles in trying to get the proper voice recognition. Now, the speaker placement and the quality of the speaker and the types of speakers we use, we're always improving. I agree with you. It is very good, but it could even be better. And so we're constantly improving our software, our hardware to get better and better voice recognition. Because I agree with you. I think that is really where it's at. When you're driving down the road, the voice rec is everything. You can pretty much power the whole car from an infotainment standpoint, OnStar, HVAC. You know, you could do everything through voice recognition. And that is, you know, you don't have to be trained there. You don't have to know which button to push. So that is an area of significant focus for us. We do spend a lot of time on it. We offer the best microphones in the industry, and we spend a lot of time on the logic and the placement of the microphones. And we're always learning. We're logging millions of miles, and that's one area where we'll be laser-like focused to get better and better.
Well, just this week, GM announced a partnership with IBM Watson. And that sounds really pretty cool and exciting, I think, to see how that plays out, because we've heard for a long time, you'll be able to interact with your car, talk to your car will know what's on your agenda, where you're going, what your patterns are. We hear this a lot. This is the first time now that GM's made this announcement that we see how it's going to play out. I'm really anxious to see it.
Yeah, it is, and it's going to be extremely powerful. I mean, when we're now able to integrate artificial intelligence with all of the features and capability we have in the vehicle, just stay tuned. The options are mind-blowing, and we're going to aggressively pursue them.
And maybe we should discuss this later. Maybe we will, but Mark Fields, the CEO of Ford, is on the IBM board of directors. And here's General Motors, the first one to put it into a car. So that's...
Wow.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I did not realize
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, we got another couple of quick questions here. Bob D. want from our audience. Bob D. wants to know, any chance of a diesel going in this?
Well, we're always considering different powertrain options. At this time, I don't have any plans, but we're always considering.
Okay, and then Roll Tide says, considering the right sizing that you talked about, did you lose any space behind the third row?
Well, again, the space behind the third row is over 20 cubic feet. The space behind the, if you put down the second row, is 42, and then it's 79 with all three rows lowered. Again, I'd have to look at the statistics to see where we are today.
Yeah. Maybe Joanne knows the answer.
Yeah. I don't,
well,
but,
yeah,
but...
Bring home your groceries in 2017, and let's see how many more bags we'll have.
I'll get back to you on that.
But it's a very efficient use of space, and cargo capacity, cargo volume, and how you reconfigure that cargo was extremely important to us. So, for example, the third row you can easily reach to function down. Mm-hmm. The second row, just a small anecdote, what we found is you certainly, one thing that's very annoying is if you forgot to lower your second row of seating, you got to walk all the way around, you got to put it down. Well, what we offered are two simple levers at the back of the car where you simply pull it. So from the back area with one bag of groceries, you can lower that second row and have very functional use of that cargo space. Mm-hmm. So one small thing we're able to do to help the customer.
We've got one last question here from the audience. Harsha V says he'd like to know if the size reduction combined with it being the first Lambda redone is a regret due to lower sales. He points out that Acadia sales are down 22.4% so far this year. But I'm wondering if that's just running down the old model to bring up the new one.
Yeah, actually, you know, very much to the contrary. You know, last year, which was our full Acadia sales year, was one of the best years we've ever had with Acadia. I mean, it's phenomenal how that vehicle, the GMC Acadia, really defined the segment, and the sales continued strong all the way throughout. You know, he's probably comparing it to this year's sales, which really tapered down to make room for the new Acadia model.
Right. So that was Joanne's model to make room for the new one.
That was intentional, and that was very deliberate. Actually, the Acadia has been very strong as a larger vehicle, but as we started talking to people again, I think we've moved the new Acadia to the new sweet spot in the market. And again, if early sales are any indication, it seems like we have hit that spot.
Well, turn rate is a good indication of how the market likes or doesn't like a car. So if you got the fastest turn rate in GM, that's pretty impressive.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to have to wrap this up. But, Paul, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Maybe we'll have you back in the future with another kind of vehicle here, with another brand from General Motors. But really cool to have the Acadia in the studio with
us. That's a good car.
Thank you.
Very good.
My pleasure.
Very good.
Had a great time.
Okay. So we're going to take a quick promotional break, and we got a lot more to talk about of what's going on in this automotive industry.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
Okay, we're back. And this is the part of the show where Dr. Data takes the stage.
Okay, so this one I can't give too much early information, but it sort of plays into, you know, we're talking a little with Paul here, and he's talking about lanes, you know, he's seeing the white lines and knowing what the terrain is. And so, Carmen, could you bring up the first number, please? Okay, so here we have in 2005, 16%, double that by 2014 to 32%. So what could have had a doubling within this short period of time? And it's not a good thing.
Oh.
It's not a good thing.
Not a good thing.
So that would mean that it's probably accident-related because you told us about this lane keeping.
Sort of.
I don't know. I'm thinking 32% more vehicles drift out of their lanes these days.
Well, that would be a fair guess based on my sketchy information. So, Carmen, bring us the answer.
Oh.
U.S. roads considered poor or worse. So basically, in this 10-year period of time, it has doubled.
The number of roads in the United States that are rated as poor has doubled.
Or worse, yeah. This is according to The Economist.
That does not surprise me.
It isn't surprised me at all.
Well, it's those of us who live in Michigan.
Yeah.
Right.
Surprised.
Well, see, the thing that I thought was very striking about this is that a couple weeks ago I was at M-City, and they were talking about one of the things that they have are seven different types of curbs, because the shape of a curb affects autonomous driving. And I was thinking, wow, if a curb can have this consequence, what about these horrible potholes? And so then I was even looking further, and I was thinking, okay, how do you pay for roads? By and large, gasoline taxes. So, Carmen, can we bring up the map, please? So here is a map of the United States showing, and this is as of the 1st of October, what the gasoline taxes are. And it's amazing how widespread the numbers are different. I mean, so for example, South Carolina, 35 cents.
Per gallon tax.
Per gallon tax.
Okay.
Pennsylvania, 69 cents.
A lot more.
Washington State, 67 cents. Oklahoma, 35 cents. So the question becomes, I mean, if we're going to have autonomous vehicles, is a sufficient amount of attention being paid to the infrastructure?
No, the whole country's infrastructure needs to be
right,
rebuilt.
But I mean,
right.
So the thing of it is it sort of strikes me that even though, you know, you may have wizard-like cars, once the wizard-like cars get onto the stagecoach-like conditions, I mean, they're not going to work. And what are people going to do? They're going to be pissed off. Oh, I got this autonomous car. It doesn't work at all. Is it the car or is it the road?
Very interesting.
Yeah. So,
and what about when cars don't run on gasoline anymore? Where's the money for the roads going to come then?
Yeah.
It's a very good question. Very good question.
Well, you know, there's been all this talk of taxing based on the number of miles you drive. And then it's like, well, how are we going to monitor that? Oh, now we have to have monitors in your cars. And then the discussion goes right to Big Brother, and that's the end of that discussion.
Right. Well, some insurance companies are offering these little dongles that you're sticking in the OBD2 port. So it is actually tracking not only the miles you're driving, but speeds and other conditions.
But that's an opt-in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they give you a discount if you agree to do that.
They give you a discount assuming that you're obeying the law.
Yeah. Well, you just need hackers to feed in all the data that they want.
You know, those dongles, by the way, Verizon has one called Hum, where it will tell you, you know, it's basically turning your old car into a smart car. It can give you data on your car as well as the location, stuff like that. Well, the OBD2 port is right below the steering wheel on the right side, where my leg goes to put my my foot on the accelerator, it has a little door over it. Mm-hmm. So when you put the dongle in, the door doesn't shut. Now the door is bumping into my knee. I'm relatively short, right? But nonetheless, the point is that these, if you, unless you have a dongle in a different spot, if you have the port somewhere else, mm-hmm. it's useless to me. I sent it back. Yeah. They had me try it, and I plugged it in, and I rode about 3 miles and said, this is useless. Uh-huh. Goodbye. Uh-huh. So I don't know. There's a lot of aftermarket devices like that, but yeah. I don't think they're the answer.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you brought it up earlier. What do you think of GM putting Watson in its cars?
I thought it was really interesting, very smart. You know, obviously, we got to see how it works and how, you know, how all, like, there's just so much data out there. You know, it makes me uncomfortable. In my story, I said, you know, it's making my life easier and a little creepier, too, mm-hmm. because the car is anticipating my needs, and I'm not sure that I like that.
Well, the thing that sort of struck me about it is, you know, to your point of if you put the dongle from the insurance company that you're getting a discount on your insurance, the thing that sort of struck me about this was the fact that General Motors is working with companies like ExxonMobil and iHeartRadio, MasterCard, Parkopedia. Okay, so basically, let's take the ExxonMobil, for example, which is basically going to route you to a gas station. So are they going to pay me money by advertising to me?
Hell no. It's not about paying you money. But it's about making money off of you.
Right, but why shouldn't it be, right?
No, it should be.
I mean, you're paying for the service, right? And they're advertising to you, saying ExxonMobil station is on your route. You must stop and get gasoline because your gas tank is down. And so that, I mean, the commercial implications of this were striking to me because, okay, if you look at, say, Google, how does Google get, you know, pay for itself? By the AdWords that are on the side of the page, right?
Yep.
So you basically say, okay, I'm going to use Google. I get that, right? But here's the thing where you're paying for OnStar Go.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're using that as a means to advertise to you.
Well, but I mean, you know, the theory here is that they are providing you with, they're helping you when you need help. They are giving you information, guidance, when you need it to save you the hassle of...
Right, but what if I like Shell?
Well, they're going to add more partners.
Right. Which basically...
Yeah, but so, here's the thing is, yeah, you are getting a service out of it.
Yeah.
This is why you agreed to have mm-hmm. Big Brother take all your information. But yeah. They're taking your information and making money on it and other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not the first one to think this up, but we all need to figure out how we're going to copyright or trademark our personal data. And I'm not against them making money off me as long as I get part of the cut.
Right. So my point is that, okay, let's say that they sign up 24 vendors, right?
Okay.
So this would be Holiday Inn and McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks and fill in the blank.
CVS.
Right? CVS, Target.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So to the degree that you opt in, say, okay, I want Target and I want CVS and I want Shell and I want McDonald's.
Okay.
Right? Shouldn't that reduce your monthly fee for having the service in your car?
It should. Right? Will it? I don't think so.
Well, I know. I mean, that's the whole thing. So not only are they collecting your data, they're basically having you pay for the opportunity to get this information.
Look, this is why Silicon Valley is all over the automotive industry right now, and they recognize that the real war is over who controls the data.
Yes.
That's what it's all about. I mean, look, you know, we've talked about this before, but, you know, last week Silicon Valley blinked. You know, Apple decided it's going to bail from doing its own autonomous electric car. I'm sure Google's scratching its head now, figuring out what it's going to do. Does it really want to become an automotive supplier? I mean, did it develop all this autonomous technology to compete against the likes of Delphi and Continental and others? I kind of doubt it.
Wouldn't it be crazy if after all this hand-wringing for the last 5 years or so that the automakers come out, you know, the winners in mm-hmm. this battle?
I tell you, as of this week, it's starting to look that way.
Mm-hmm. As long as they don't screw it up.
As long as the roads get paved.
Yeah.
What else is on your list, Gary?
All right, so You know, every year there's this contest who's going to be the world's largest auto manufacturer. And so with the results for the third quarter being in, it looks as though Volkswagen Group is going to beat Toyota, which seems rather phenomenal in my estimation that, you know,
this is the Volkswagen that's been hammered for their diesel
right.
problems.
But yeah, Volkswagen AG.
Right. So this is the entire global company, and so when you drill down to the information, it basically is predicated on the fact that Volkswagen outsells Toyota about 3-1. Where?
China.
Mm-hmm. And you know, so. You know, it's very big in China. That is what's basically saving its bacon. And you know, and it occurred to me. So this week, the court finalized the fact that it'll be what $14.7 billion mm-hmm. fine that they'll have
in the United States.
In the United States, they'll have mm-hmm. to pay. So then I was looking at the VW Group sales in the United States through September. Okay, so this is the group. So this includes Audi.
And Porsche.
And so the group is down 6.9% okay, through September. And then VW division, just Volkswagen itself, is down 12.5%. And so I begin to wonder is maybe they just ought to leave the United States and go to China. What do you think?
Okay. Sounds like they would still be the number one company, even if they didn't have the U.S. But the U.S. is much too much an important market, I think. I do not think VW would leave for good. I think they're just going to keep trying like they have. They've had their ups and downs here over and over again. I mean, I think what they need, right, is a truck business.
Pickup truck.
Yes. They need to find a partner, and I can think of a couple of good ones.
Yeah.
That, you know, might be their answer in this market. They're clearly, you know, I mean, this new SUV debuted today, I believe, the Atlas. Looks good, you know, but they're entering a very crowded market.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's going to be hard for them to really get a lot of traction with that. It's great. It looks good. I'm sure it'll be competitive. But okay. Will it really rise above?
But, okay, if you say pickup truck, I mean, what kind of pickup truck? I mean, because we look at Nissan, I mean, it's still struggling with the new Titan. I mean, the Titan's a very nice truck, but, you know, the big three seem to have a lock on that market. I mean, how many years Toyota's been trying, you know, trying to chip away at it, and that's not working out so well.
I continue to say I think that VW and Fiat Chrysler make
a great
mix.
Good combination.
Yeah, I mean, Chrysler needs cars. Volkswagen needs trucks. Right.
But that means Volkswagen has to buy FCA, and they just paid $14.7 billion out, and they're going to pay a whole lot more when the court cases really start to hit.
Well, yeah.
And that's just in the United States.
Yes.
Right. So what are they going to pay?
They've got a big problem in Korea.
Right.
Volkswagen. Yeah. I don't know how many cars they sell there, but they're completely off the market in Korea now.
You know, and they do have a pickup truck in Europe. It's like Anorak, I think it's called.
Right.
And it's a beautiful truck, but, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, it's so expensive that, I mean, it would be like... You know, not even having the platinum trim level on, you'd be paying a nosebleed amount of money. Oh, yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Mercedes is going to have a pickup truck, not in the U.S., but did you get a look at that thing?
Yeah. It looked pretty good. Well, all I saw was a sketch.
Yeah. Well, this week they had
pictures.
They showed like real, they had some event in Stockholm or something where they had two sort of variants. They were concept variants, but they were real metal, sheet metal.
Mm-hmm.
One was, you know, sort of the urban kind of vehicle, and the other was the stylish or the outdoor adventure version, whatever. You know, I just
so
don't
basically,
see
it's
it.
The Mercedes Ridgeline.
Yeah.
Yeah. And isn't it based on a Nissan platform?
It is. Nissan and Renault are going to build it in Spain and in Argentina, I believe. It's only going to be sold in Europe, South America, South Africa, and Australia for now.
For now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they're laying the groundwork to try to get into the American market at some point.
I don't know. There's a kind of a long history of goofy pickup trucks in this.
There are.
In this mm-hmm. market.
A lot of wannabes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, look, I know we got more stuff to get to, but we got to take another quick commercial break here. Carmen, let's give some good airtime to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. And Gary, what else you want to talk about here?
So Tesla made money.
Some money.
What?
$22 million. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
real money.
Yeah, they've
Gap money.
Yeah, gap money.
Wow.
$22 million. I mean, you know, in this business, you know, that falls out of your pocket.
Error.
Yeah, yeah. When you think about how the road they've been on, that's mm-hmm. good news.
Well, you know it is, but is it sustainable? You know, because they had a profit, what, for one quarter 3 years ago? And, mm-hmm. boy, they blew the trumpets on that, mm-hmm. you know, for a couple of years. So, you know, one quarter doesn't impress me, and that's easy to do. You go, you know, let's not pay some bills for the end of the month and drop that money to the bottom line, and woohoo, we got a profit.
And, oh, let's ask all of our dealers, or our, not our dealers, yeah. whatever they call them, our representatives, to push the sales through, do whatever you can to make sales. But, mm-hmm. oh, don't discount.
Mm-hmm. And then they, still, they had $139 million selling credits.
Mm-hmm.
So ZEV offsets, but
that's legit.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. I mean, because it's like, okay, they earned that money.
Sure,
right?
They did
by making
that's part of their business strategy.
But you know,
what's
one of the things that even though it was, you know, just, you know, a snapshot of, you know, one quarter they did this, I thought this was interesting that in their announcement about this, they pointed out that Model S deliveries grew nearly 60% year over year, increasing its lead status with a 32% share of the top 12 selling large luxury sedans. And you know, you've mentioned this before about how, you know, they are really dominating
at
that
top
space.
Top of the market, man. They got market share that no one can believe they've achieved.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then so they have the other model because they have the S, and then they have the Model X. And
the
so
SUV.
The SUV, and it says, despite still ramping production, Model X is also gaining market share, already growing to 6% of the U.S. large luxury SUV market in Q3, or number 8 in the large luxury SUV category. And this is the part that's interesting. Edging out the Porsche Macan and the Cayenne, Land Rover RR Sport, and the Infiniti QX80. So here they are.
That's saying something.
Right. I mean,
That's very interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
Blah, blah, blah. The large luxury SUV category is 3 times the size of the large luxury sedan category in the U.S. and represents a huge opportunity to further increase Model X sales. So what do you think? Smoke and mirrors?
I think it's
smoke?
Legit. Yeah, maybe. Look.
No, they're electric. They don't have any smoke.
Yeah, that's right. If they do, you're in trouble.
Just coming off the tires in ludicrous mode. Yeah. Anyway.
You know, clearly there is a certain segment of the population that is fascinated by the innovation, the technology, and the powertrain in those vehicles. I happen to think that Model X in particular has a very low ceiling, and not just because the doors will go up and hit the ceiling, but those doors are you know, fairly impractical for a lot of people, and you know, the price of these vehicles also, there's a limit to how many people can afford that. So that brings you to the Model 3. If they can replicate this kind of success with Model 3, look out. I mean, they're here to stay. That is a huge if, though, and I have been very skeptical about their ability to ramp up production in the factory that they have in Silicon Valley and crank out in numbers the kinds of cars that they're talking about.
Right.
At quality, price.
So
speaking of quality, Consumer Reports came out with their list of most reliable or least reliable, mm-hmm. and Tesla didn't do so hot.
Tesla is down at number 25 of 29.
But you should know when you parse those a little bit, most of that was with X problems. S has actually improved.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that right?
Yes. Yes. So,
well, but they were saying that finally that they will not rate in this survey unless you have more than one model. And
right.
So now that they do have X and they were able to include that suddenly it doesn't make the company look so good. But, you know, we were talking about Buick before, and so Buick is the number 3 most reliable vehicle brand out there now. So it's behind Lexus and Toyota.
I think it's overdue, frankly. I mean, I have been saying for a long time, GM is making great cars. Mm-hmm. Chevrolet, I think, did pretty well on that, too.
Yeah, but Chevrolet's at 15.
Well, and a lot of that was the trucks. The trucks have been lousy.
And a lot of what they sell are
trucks, yes. But I believe, like, the was it the Malibu? I forget which one. One of their top-selling cars did quite well, too, on mm-hmm. the Chevrolet side. I don't have the numbers, the data in front of me. But I find it interesting. You know, one of the reasons Buick did so well was because they don't have trucks. And so that wasn't pulling
them. Well, they were also saying the other thing is that because some of their models are a little...
dated.
Mature.
Mature.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
And
they worked out the kinks.
And so with a lot of so Honda, for example, getting nicked because of the interface problems with the infotainment package, say in the new Civic. I mean, a lot of people are not happy with.
Oh yeah. You know, oh yeah. That's why they've gone back to a rotary knob for volume because people hated that sliding feature, the swiping feature.
Right.
The new system is much better in the new Hondas.
Mm-hmm.
Still not my favorite.
Right.
You know, man, to me, as you judge cars nowadays, to me, that's the number one thing I look at is the infotainment, the ease of use.
Mm-hmm.
No, I appreciated what Paul was saying earlier about their system because GM's is pretty darn good. Chrysler's is good.
Except that Chrysler's products scored abysmally in the consumer report.
They got lousy transmissions.
All right, let's see.
And a lot of other problems.
All right, so I mentioned earlier that there are 29 companies on the list.
Yeah.
So let's see what number 26 is. Dodge, number 27, Chrysler, number 28, Fiat, number 29, Ram.
Yeah.
Where's Jeep?
Well, not much better.
Tesla, 23.
Right? Okay. Yeah.
Unfortunately, just right ahead of Jeep is
GMC.
Mm-hmm.
Yowza.
Actually behind them, actually.
A couple of suppliers have told me just in the last 2 weeks that Chrysler Purchasing is now putting more emphasis on quality than they've ever seen before. And they're not beating them up for price. They're beating them up for quality. Mm-hmm. So I think the people at the top at FCA are starting to get the message.
Well, we were talking a little earlier, the Chrysler Pacifica minivan, mm-hmm. Brand new. They've got an electric plug-in version or hybrid version. It's phenomenal. It really is phenomenal.
I totally agree. I just drove the plug-in last week.
Yeah.
I was knocked out at how good it was.
The question is the quality going to be there? God, I hope so.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that deserves to be a great car, a great vehicle.
Although I'll also hasten to add, as I've said every time, I've got huge issues with the way that Consumer Reports measures quality.
Yeah.
Huge issues.
All
I don't think
it's
scientific, and I think it's worth taking a look at. If I was an automaker, I'd worry where I get ranked, because to the general public, Consumer Reports is as good as the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't do well there, you're really in trouble from a perception standpoint. But I don't buy the fact that it's scientifically valid.
Well, it says Consumer Reports 2016 Annual Auto Reliability Survey gathered information from Consumer Reports subscribers which is obviously a subset of
car buyers,
normal humanity,
right?
Who collectively owned or leased over 500,000 vehicles from model years 2000 to 2016, with a smattering of 2017, covering more than 300 models. So, I mean, if you subscribe to the magazine,
and if you fill out the survey,
right?
So there's a subset of a subset,
right?
You might only fill out the survey if you had something bad to say.
Right.
If you thought it was great, you might not bother. Oh, you know.
Yeah. Although, but if you look at some, you look at the top 10. I mean, Lexus, Toyota, Buick, Audi, Kia, Mazda, Hyundai, Infiniti, BMW, Honda. I mean, it's the usual suspects. I mean,
Kia surprises me.
No, but if you look at J.D. Power, though, that Kia came out in number one. Mm-hmm. So that was the first ever
IQS.
Korean, yeah, and it was like the first time that happened in, I think, 30 years in 29 years ago, it was Toyota.
Right.
So every year since, there has never been a mainstream car maker that has hit it as these guys have. So the Kia doesn't surprise me in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly they've gotten better. You look skeptical.
Well, I have to agree with John on the data. I'm J.D. Power, to me, same thing. I don't necessarily think that any of these surveys.
Numbers.
Yeah,
I don't trust their numbers.
I mean, you know, they're in business to sell these
surveys.
But if you've noticed, J.D. Power will, every couple of years, they change their survey.
Change all the metrics.
Because everything's kind of converging, you know,
and otherwise
it becomes harder.
Yeah, we'd all say, hey, look, everything is as good as the top Toyotas were 5 years ago. So,
right.
Anyway,
right.
Speaking of quality, I do like the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety
yes.
bringing up this stuff about headlamps. And they just had a survey that came out this week that said, hey, all these pickup trucks have lousy headlamps. What do you guys make of this? I mean, and yet, you know it. We all test drive different cars. And every now and then you get in a car and you go, ooh, these headlights are really good. You notice it when they're good.
Yeah. I notice it when they're in my rearview mirror, when there's a pickup truck behind me and is blinding me. But
So they came out and there was one that was good. That was the new Ridgeline, okay? And acceptable. This is what I don't understand, okay? Keep speaking of things that are inexplicable. Okay, acceptable is the GMC Sierra, but poor was the Silverado.
Different headlamps is all I can imagine.
It must be an up. Level kind of trim.
It must be, you know, right? And so then earlier...
Professional grade.
Earlier this year, they came out with one for mid-sized cars, and the only one that was ranked good was the Prius V, okay, mm-hmm. just the V. But they pointed out the Prius V earns a good rating when equipped with LED lights and high beam assist. To get those headlights, consumers must purchase the advanced technology package, which is only available on the highest trim level. When equipped with regular halogen lights and without high beam assist, the Prius V earns a poor rating.
Yeah.
So it's either the best or it's got a poor rating. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just like, so that seems a little, and as I read into this, I mean, a lot of it has to do with glare, whether there's glare off to the sides. And so I begin to wonder, I mean, what are they really saying?
They're saying the headlights aren't very good. I got to tell you, I just finished test driving a Nissan Armada, which I thought was pretty good overall. But dang, if those headlights weren't terrible. And trying
That's
to look
so
off
funny
to the
you said
side.
That. I'm driving it right now, and yeah. I had the same thought.
No kidding.
Yes.
Yeah. So especially, like, if I'm turning left, it's like a big dark at night.
Yeah.
The headlights, there's no light there. I have to.
I thought they weren't even on.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's so, really not good.
No.
And it's so amazing to me. You know, we get all the safety equipment, you know, forward collision warning, you know, lane keeping this, airbags all over the place. And the stupid headlights aren't any good.
Yeah, lights are overrated.
Well, if I had X-ray vision, too, I might say the same.
So I wonder how many, what percentage of vehicles have the LED lights these days? Most?
Or
no.
Just,
no.
Tends they're to be too expensive
the
still?
Well, yeah. There's... the daytime running lamps, mm-hmm. almost everyone's gone to LED because they're always on, right?
Okay.
But if you're talking about beams, you know, high and low beams, and that being LED, tends to only be the more expensive cars that have got that.
And you know, the thing that is sort of ironic about this is that if you look at any part of a car that more time, attention, and money is spent on than any other of late... Headlights.
It's the headlights.
Everybody's talking about
their
headlights.
But it's all about styling.
Right.
Not about
actually
projecting lumens.
Right. I mean, and you would think that because people are spending so much time on them that they would actually be far superior than you'd ever imagined, right? I mean, what automaker doesn't say, oh, look at this headlight we have. Oh, we put a little logo in there. And you can see it inside there.
Thing.
Oh, yeah. And they never talk about the replacement cost in case of an accident. So,
especially with those cameras and stuff in there now, right? And the tail lamps in particular, I'm thinking. But
well, cameras are actually pretty cheap. But I'm talking about the headlamps, the LED headlamps. If you have like an Audi, let's say an A7 or something like that, and it gets crunched, I'm going off the top of my head here, but I want to say it's $2,500 replacement cost per headlamp.
Oh, geez.
Because, you know, you see all this jewelry stuff. What you don't see is all the electronics that reside behind that. And it's horrifically expensive to repair those things.
Good thing cars aren't going to crash in a while, right? Soon we're going to have cars that don't crash. We don't have to worry about our headlights.
You don't need light. They're going to drive themselves. Yeah, who needs to see? You won't even be looking anyway. You'll be looking at your phone or something.
Right, playing Monopoly.
That's right.
Hey, look, we're going to have to wrap this up. This has been really good, but... it's time to wrap it up. Joanne, thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you, John.
And I think it was really cool that you've got the old generation Acadia to be able to compare it to the new. That was
and
really
I,
valuable.
You know, the new one I like a lot better.
Cool.
Not that I don't like the current one, but I really like the new one.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So how do you feel when you, you know, get into the old one having driven the new one?
I feel like I'm like climbing into a big truck. It's
big.
It's too wide. It's too high. You know, it just feels big.
Mm-hmm. And it is big.
Yeah, it is. I didn't realize how big it was when we bought it, I think. Mm-hmm. But, so it fits in the garage right now, so that's okay.
All right, I want to tell everybody December. They want to watch the December 1st show because you were driving Audi this week. I drove the Alfa Romeo Giulietta this week.
Yeah.
And so we've got a show with Reid Bigland, the CEO of Alfa Romeo. We got Richard Cox, who is the global product planning for Alfa. We have the chief engineer for that car. And it's a good show.
We recorded that show. And it's going to air, you said, December
1st, yeah. Okay. And
cool.
We got some good journalists on the panel. We got Tim Stevens from Roadshow, Rebecca Lindland from Kelley Blue Book, and Tony Quiroga of Car and Driver. And so it's
I'll want to watch that one.
Yeah, you got to write this down.
Yeah, yeah.
December 1st.
Good deal.
Are you going to be speaking Italian?
I would say no in Italian, but I don't know how to say it.
And with that, we wrap it up.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.